The Off The Ball Podcast Network.
Yeah, you're very welcome along to Tuesday morning's OTBAM. We're here with you every morning from 7.30 until 9.30. Andy Lee is with us this morning. Andy, how are you?
Grand, yeah. How are you?
It's early, isn't it?
It's a good start, yeah. It's a good start.
Would you have been like a dawn riser when you were training for fights?
No, not necessarily, no.
Because there was nothing else to do all day, so why would you get up early? That was
The old adage would be that you'd run in the morning for two reasons, mainly because you haven't had any food, so you can run and then you'd be burning off fat instead of food energy.
Okay.
And also the air is fresher in the morning. But I would run about, but usually around 8 a.m.
Right, so this is in Detroit?
In America, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Would you have had training camps away from the city?
Yeah, a lot of the time we would have been like Poconos or Florida, right, or different places in Europe if it was with Klitschko. That was only in those days I used to run early, but later on in my career...
You were like, I'm going to run late.
It's 11 a.m. start.
That's fair enough. Do you miss that bit of like your career where, you know, the endless possibilities of what was coming next over the next 8 weeks were there? Or was that...
A lot of uncertainty, you know, a lot of, like, just unstable. It's not a very unstable kind of life, you know, that it's every fight, it's fight by fight, you know, and if you don't win, then your prospects look, you know, not as good of what, you like, you know, you're planning your year, or there's no planning, you know, that's it, that's the way it is, and I used to, like, drive by, and be, like, leaving the gym and driving by people having drinks on a Friday afternoon and thinking, like, God, I'd love to have been doing that, you know what I mean? But just for the stability and the structure, but you do miss the training. You miss the endorphins, you miss like the buzz of it, and you miss obviously the physical benefits of it.
Camp itself, was that the best part then, where you knew you had this, like for the next 8 weeks at least, you know, every minute is mapped out and there's a reason for it?
Yeah, there's a goal. And then you know, obviously a few weeks after, immediately after fight, you can just kind of relax and decompress. But then as soon as that's over, like you're thinking, when's the next fight?
Yeah.
Where is the next fight?
Has anything replaced that, the endorphins and the...
No, I don't think so. I don't think anything ever will, so you don't really chase, you know, not really looking for that. Just enjoy it for what it was now. And I've become a regular on the dad cast, because that's where I spend most of my time. But other than that, now I'm training the young lad.
Yeah, how's that gone?
It's gone good. He's making his debut October 11th.
Right.
His name is Paddy Donovan.
And are you more nervous about that now than you might have been for your own debut?
Maybe when it comes to the night, you know, but we're pretty much on top of things. I'm very confident in him. He's a good kid.
What type of fighter is he?
He's flash. He's flashy. But he's a southpaw and he's a puncher. There are similarities there. But it's, I don't know. The main challenge with him is because two things. He's so talented, he's never had to work hard to be successful. So I have to, like, kind of ingrain that in him to show him what real work is as a professional. And try to just ease him back a bit because he's so eager.
Yeah.
And he just wants to kill everything, like, so.
I presume that's the hardest part of a young fighter, is that they see some fighters, if they have the right backing, you know, if they're chosen, they get to go through the path pretty quickly. And we realise that in the long run, you kind of have to serve your time. You need to fight the rounds. You need to get the experience.
Exactly. And even, down to the matchmaking, finding the right opponents, guys who will test him a little bit or challenge him. So that's the thing as well. He has to be challenged because he can easily become, not bored, but complacent because he is so talented, you know, and think that this is so easy. So I just want to give him enough of a challenge to keep him on his toes as well.
Are you a good trainer? Is this like, what? How do you know?
I don't know. I'm learning as he's learning, you know. And
yeah. Is this the right thing to do today?
Yeah. Well, you're just thinking about it at night time the day before, like, what will we do tomorrow and how can I, you know, where can he improve? It's like verbalising what I want him to do is more difficult, but I have a little advantage because I can display it, you know, in terms of I can give him like I want you to do with your hip or with your hand or whatever it is, and then can he mimic that, you know, and that'll...
You were quite a technical fighter. Is that the part of the game that's the easiest bit to explain in a way?
In a way, but it's also a challenge because I think, like, especially when he's... I think in the moment, I think he'll do something, then I'll think about it. And the next day, I'll be able to verbalize it a lot better. I'll think about it overnight and tell him, okay, this. But he's seen, like, he's had some good spars recently. And the things that we've been telling him to do, when he does them, he can see the benefits of them, you know. So that's positive, yeah.
And how do you work on just a hip placement or a...
It's very hard. It's hard because... And as well, it's not something that anyone will change overnight. It's something that you'll have to be reminded constantly and drill it, because he's been ingrained in the amateur style of boxing as well for a long time. So these changes will happen over, like, incrementally over a long time.
It's not like football where you can just kick with your left foot for an hour and at the end of it you'll be a little bit better and the next day you do it again.
Yeah, you can do that, you know. The human body's amazing, isn't it? Like, isn't it? In a way,
yes.
Like when you're trained, when you're in great shape, like, you know, like if I was just to jump in a corner and jump, like, by tomorrow I'll probably be able to jump a little bit higher than I could today, you know. So you can make those little small,
yeah,
marginal gains.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And is that the best part about it? Then the teaching when it comes off the next.
Yeah,
day,
and like, seeing it, and then also getting a little buzz and seeing it, and it's a bit easy because he's so good. So it's not, you know.
Okay, that
it's
helps.
Not that, it's not. That bad.
Definitely helps. 7:37 this morning. I'll tell you what's coming up on the show. We've got we're going to come back to boxing and talk Tyson Fury and what else is happening in the world a little bit later on. We're going to cross over to Japan after 8 o'clock to hear from Rory O'Connor and Owen Sheehan. There's the latest in the NFL after an amazing weekend with Mike Carlson. It's coming your way around about 8:30. Football and the sports news with Phil Egan is coming your way after 9 o'clock. We're going to stream the Irish press conference live from about 8:45 a.m. Brian O'Driscoll was in the studio last night. Here's what he made of Ireland's opening. Have a look.
What about the performance? What did we see here?
Yeah, really good first performance, really good. Just, you know, built on really good foundations. You know, relatively low error count considering the condition, particularly the second half. Built their scores brilliantly well. Again, I think some key contributors really stepped up to the plate. Conor Murray, really great 60 minutes. Thought some of the pack were outstanding. Great to see CJ Stander back, carrying really well, tackling ferociously. And then, you know, what happened with the three forwards tries in the first 20 minutes just set the tone for the rest of the game. So overall, they would, you know, would have to be very, very pleased. Trying to contain themselves a little bit, as much as we'd be containing the, you know, the public expectation and excitement and my own, because I really felt as though is it a step too far to say it was the performance so far of the World Cup? Maybe not. I think New Zealand looked very good in parts, but I think as an overall 80 minute performance of just being in maximum control of the game, I think definitely it was a performance, the performance of 2019, that's for sure.
Yeah, from Ireland, definitely. Yeah, that's that. I mean, 3 weeks ago we were like, what's the point in going to the World Cup? Maybe we could pull out.
I know, it's amazing, you know, the difference in one result, but
maybe the truth is somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think it always is.
Dab it down again for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, Japan next.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're going to handle Japan. I think in fairness, it's Ireland against South Africa in the quarterfinals, and we all know it's coming. So there's 3 weeks of, like, don't get injured.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. So it's just managing up to that point.
It doesn't matter if we scrape through those games. Like, yeah, if we win with a drop goal in the last minute.
Well, I think you want to win them with a bit of same kind of confidence going into that match.
But I know that we can produce that performance again, and I know that we can definitely put a one off. What needs to happen is that our best players are all fit. That's the key thing, and how many minutes you give them so that they stay fresh and they stay sharp while at the same time battle hardened.
Yeah, it is looking good though. Like, you're reading the reports, it all seems positive.
I know, yeah, it's terrible. It's a terrible situation as a sport fan to be like, oh no, that we have a chance of winning here. How are we supposed to deal with that? But I think we've got a bit better at it as Irish people dealing with favouritism. Let's start with the newspapers this morning. So I'm going to start with the Irish Independent. Loads of good stories. Schmidt to ring the changes for Japan, so the news is starting to break that we're going to use fresh players against the host nation. I'll get into the details of that a little bit more later on. I know Rory O'Connor has been speaking with Owen Sheehan. We'll bring you that just after 8 o'clock this morning. And then Troy Parrott might get his first start tonight. Certainly he expects to play for Spurs. So he could travel to Colchester for the first team tonight, and he's one of a group of young Irish players hoping to impress. Caoimhín Kelleher and Aaron Connolly may also be in line for starts. So from a situation where we'd no young footballers a couple of years ago to suddenly having loads of good young footballers, the future's looking fairly bright for Ireland. Celebrating Dundalk last night, league champions for the fifth time in six seasons. Sean Hoare celebrates after opening the scoring for Dundalk last night's 3-2 win over Rovers at Oriel Park. That sealed yet another SSE Airtricity League Premier Division title for the Lady Whites. And then this one, an amazing story coming out of Meath. Hired GAA body to review Meath chairman's message to ref. Colin Keyes and Michael Verney of this story. Meath County Board is to ask a higher GAA authority, whoever that may be, to investigate a complaint made against its former chairman, Peter O'Halloran, by referee Patrick Nealis over the content of a WhatsApp message O'Halloran sent in 2017. So the message obviously only recently came to light in recent weeks, and it prompted O'Halloran to step down on Friday, citing an error of judgment. So O'Halloran, who was then the chairman of the county's CCC, said to Nealis, who was the referee, that he would be sending him to ride Slane in a month or so. Nealis said he was shocked by the request and didn't respond initially, but then followed it up a few weeks later on the advice of friends he consulted with, asking what he was required to go to Slane in the hope that the initial text was not meant. The response was, in May or June when things die down. So, it never obviously transpired, but O'Halloran and Nealis have confirmed the request was never carried out. O'Halloran said in a statement this week that he sent it in the heat of the moment, adding that it was a bad call that he deeply regretted. He's been Meath chairman since December 2017 and has had to stand down. So, the chairman was allegedly asking a referee to ride a different club in a match.
Nice turn of phrase.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, look.
I said the better.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I'm sure there'll be plenty of legal ramifications and the examination will be interesting. But yeah, I mean, boxing has its own referees riding people.
Yeah. That kind of links into a story that's on the back of, it's on a few things. This is the Times Sport, I guess. Down here, Russia faces world sports ban, and it's about Rusada, who has apparently deleted some information about positive tests sent to WADA.
Right.
And they could be expelled from all sports. All sports that participate in WADA governed, you know, sport.
Yeah, I guess.
Events. But like recently, there was the World Amateur Boxing Championships last week were held in Russia. And it was, what you'd expect, amateur boxing being in Russia. But it was being governed by AIBA, which are now banned from the Olympics. So it was a bit of a strange one. It was originally going to be a qualifier for the Olympics, because since they've been expelled, they've lost their Olympic status, AIBA. This was just a world championships. But what I meant is that how it links in was that there was a lot of questionable decisions and referees and chairmen and
it's mad, isn't it?
Because
they had the perfect amateur scoring system where everybody could see it. It was transparent. The points, it was great, and it really made those fights. You in the moment, you knew who was winning.
Yeah, but it was still very, very dodgy.
At least it was a step in the right direction.
There was enough kind of ambiguity where three of the fighters had to press the button within a second of each other for it to register a point. So, you know, they could fiddle it a little bit, you know, but
just look left.
But like there was one of the British boxers, Fraser Clark, super heavyweight, beat the Russian, and it was a tight fight. Could have went either way, but he beat him. Was given the decision. The Russian Federation appealed the decision, and then it was overturned.
Oh, wow.
They awarded the fight to the Russian athlete.
That almost never happens, right?
Never happens. And then they gave no explanation and would offer no explanation.
Right.
So, but there was a few of those going on. But
they saw sense. Somebody made them see sense.
Yeah.
The Times London, England test snub, a shock for Bairstow. And then there's a picture of George North scoring Wales' sixth try as they overcome a second-half wobble to defeat Georgia 43-14 in their first World Cup match. And Manchester United's Pogba contract talks. Man United have opened preliminary talks with Paul Pogba over a new contract as they look to persuade him to stay at Old Trafford. It's hard to know if this is designed to try and protect their investment so that they can insert a clause that's the right buyout number for everybody to be happy, or if it is actually the intention of Manchester United to double down and make Paul Pogba the star of their team into the future.
I know, it's kind of like he doesn't play against Leicester, and then they kind of, I'm not sure, Matic is just not up to it, but like,
no.
Well, he got a good result. If it's not, even if not, it's not the United, you know, result, like score line that you'd associate with a United game at home. But then against West Ham, he's not playing. He would have made a difference in that match, probably in the kind of the type of match it was.
He's better than the three they have at the minute. So, yeah, he definitely would make a difference. And if he was tuned in every week and he decided that he wanted to be an absolute club legend forever, well then...
That's probably the biggest question and the biggest doubt as well, is it?
Yeah, I think so. I think if he was into it, he'd be brilliant. Because we saw at the World Cup how amazing he was for France when there was a very specific role that he was performing in a team who had very good players around him. So you kind of feel that too. I'm sorry, just looking for the sports section here in the Times. If you want
to... Yeah, I've got the Mirror Sport, totally lost ints. United have no direction, no identity, and only interest in cash. And he's more, this is more pointed at Edward Woodward, yeah. It's only a couple of lines. You know, it's one of these big back pages and then it has a small section in the inside, but he's basically saying that he's not happy with Woodward and the direction the club's going. And he kind of backs Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, but it's kind of across all the papers, isn't it? It's kind of running across. There's more of that that carries on. Also, Red Steel did a double. Klopp and Alisson win awards for the FIFA awards. Dundalk, whitewashes on. They're going to go for a treble. And Ireland escaped the glare where Joe Smith has taken them away from the busy crowds in Japan.
Yeah.
It's a good move, I think.
Hard to do as well. So the Irish Times this morning is Japanese message on the challenge Ireland pose is not lost in translation. And here's that picture of Japan's prop is Leili Nakajima during training at the Hamamatsu ground that Owen was talking about yesterday. Healy and Ireland back in the bubble. So this is just pre-World Cup. There's a lot of print to fill between matches because the games are not the 3 days apart that they are in the Soccer World Cup. They're obviously 6 day turnaround for us. Ireland forwards a match for any other pack in the world. And there's the match report yesterday from Wales.
That's the thing, is that with the 6 days, there's enough time for people to get kind of bought into the hype, isn't it? You know, like, because they have to fill the pages, so they have to make these kind of things, and people, and it'll be interesting to see if the performance is not as good against Japan, what the following 6 days are.
Yeah, exactly. And that's how it's, you know, that's how it must be very easy for teams to talk themselves into a death spiral.
Yeah.
And, like, just get carried away, either with the hype or with the negativity, whereas actually the games are the things that matter. So that's the Times for you. The Examiner this morning, they've got a big feature on James Ryan. Man at Work. Ireland coach Schmidt salutes workaholic Ryan. They've got a couple of pieces inside to just show how important he's become for Ireland. Ronan O'Gara's column today saying that France could face Wales in a World Cup quarter-final and I wouldn't bet against them. He was saying that the sporting director at La Rochelle said France not very good at rugby at the moment except at World Cups. And we're obviously, you know, traditionally the opposite, not very good at World Cups. But they won in, I don't know if you saw the Argentina game at the weekend, a weird game. They were sensational in the first half. Argentina get back, get in front. France make a substitution and the guy comes off the bench. His first touch is a drop goal that just squirts over the bar, and then Argentina missed a penalty, which would have won the game for them. From distance, in fairness, but a great game. And I think Argentina could give England a match as well. And they also have a big feature interview this morning, which they don't put on the front page, funnily enough, with Jarlett Burns, who has announced that he wants to be the president of the GAA. We need to ask difficult questions of ourselves. What are we? Who are we? Why do we exist? He's calling for another strategic review, basically. There was one in 2001, which was obviously where the notion of investing so much money in Dublin came from. They did also suggest splitting Dublin in two. They gave him the money, but they didn't split them in two. And he's saying it's time for another strategic review to decide what role the GAA should have in society and how they should interact with the rest of the country. Really?
Big questions.
There are big questions, and it's like important sometimes to ask yourself big questions, especially if you're going for the biggest job in office, as opposed to some of the other candidates who haven't really said that they have a philosophy other than keeping it going.
Yeah. Don't know. What? Yeah.
You were never interested in boxing politics or getting involved or getting...
No, it's not. There's no, like, boxing is just a crazy, chaotic kind of... It's not even an organisation because they're not, no way organised. You know? So you can't even compare it to the GAA or anything like that or any decent
governing body, you know, sport, whatever, federation. So, no.
No, fair enough. The back of the Star this morning, two done, one to go. So Dundalk, two-thirds of the way on their way to a treble. Vinnie Perth targeted a first-ever Dundalk treble after a fifth league title in 6 years was claimed last night. They did it in style as well. And they also have the story, GAA to investigate events in Meath. So Brian Flanagan has this story. Yeah, it's going to now be carried out by a higher GAA authority. So the county boards were informed of the message content by the referee, and the Slane Club also made contact with the board to let them know they were aware of the message. So that's also their Troy Parrott and Queevan Keller in line for a debut as well. And Seamus Coleman has been told by Marco Silva his Everton place is under threat from Djibril Sidibe. Well, they spent a lot of money on Sidibe, and it looked like that was always going to be the case, but been no sign of him losing his place just yet. Maybe it's on its way.
Yeah, I've got the Herald Sport. Spurs tip teenage ace Troy. It's continuing on in all the papers. Mick keeps tabs on Parrott as first team debut looms, which would be great to see him get his first team debut, wouldn't it? You know.
Yeah. Yeah, because maybe then we could pick him for Ireland.
Well, that's what, you know, he said if he starts playing for Tottenham, but I don't think if he plays in the Carabao Cup, I don't think that kind of qualifies. I think if he's regularly starting or getting a sub, getting a few minutes in the Premier League, then it's...
What if he's already our best striker?
I know. Well...
Stick him in, right?
You do, yeah. 17, though, it's a big jump, isn't it? You know, from that kind of playing against people who you're kind of physically, you know, comfortable against than playing against men. It is a big difference.
It is. And we'll see how he goes tonight. If he can look after himself in the lower reaches of English football, I'm sure he'll be able to look after himself in the game. So, City Star of the Dock, no joke. Kick it out, slam racist tweet as FA investigates. Bernardo larks around with Mendy during a training session yesterday. So, Bernardo Silva tweeted in a racist manner about Benjamin Mendy, and there's no ifs, ands, or buts. It was a racist tweet. And so he should face a ban for it. But it doesn't look like that might happen just yet. Perth, core the merrier. Vinnie Perth insists the pressure is on to enhance Dundalk's legacy. So they're doing a good job so far. Messi gets past Van Dijk to net gong. This was interesting last night. The FIFA awards were given out. And Leo Messi won his sixth, which is a record at the FIFA awards for their best ceremony at Milan's La Scala Opera. And Leeds United won the... Was it sportsmanship? Was that the whatever it was? It was
they loved
fair play.
To just to equalise.
Yeah, for the Villa thing. Yeah, this is Leeds United who were also spying on their opponents last week. It's like,
yeah, I didn't see what the big outrage was about that spy and the spy gate. You know, like if you can get an advantage by sending someone to watch your opponents and they don't have anything, like, you know. If they're not, like, training behind closed doors and people are not fed and going in there, then you'd send somebody to watch him. Like, if I could watch one of my opponents training and see who he's sparring, you'd want to know.
Yeah, you probably could, couldn't you? Most training sessions are...
Yeah, you wouldn't send anybody, like, you know.
You're one of your mates.
Yeah.
Well, you need to be somebody below the radar.
Yeah, somebody going in as under the guise of, you know...
A journalist
wandering in off the street. What is this place, a boxing gym?
Oh, you look pretty good. Are you fighting soon, son? Mum's the word for Murphy in Middle Park, with Pinatubo lurking in wait for those brave enough to line up for next month's Dewhurst Stakes. The judgment Middle Park offers up an attractive alternative Group 1 at Newmarket on Saturday, and it's going to be a cracker, according to the Racing Post. And they've also got a feature on John Gosden. And then in the back, it's treble winners should maintain their grip on the EFL Cup. This is trophy hog Pep Guardiola pulling out a good team tonight, because all the players he has at the minute are pretty good from their perspective. I want to show you this one. This is the Star in the UK. This is the front page of the Daily Star. Boxer Carl, the earth is 100% flat. He might be wrong, but do you want to tell him?
Yeah, Carl Froch. He said this on a few different podcasts now, but I actually did his coverage earlier on this year, back in April, and very much into his conspiracies, Carl Froch.
So he believes the Earth is flat? Has he not fought in like part other parts of the world?
He has. He famously was delayed going to Denmark to fight Mikkel Kessler because of the volcano. So I'm not sure if he got to look out the window. But yeah, it's a mad one. This flat earth is a kind of, it's mad, isn't it?
It's so obviously easily disproved. Especially when you're rich like Carl Froch, you think I'm just going to...
I know, if you live in middle America and it's pretty much is flat because there's not many mountains around the place, maybe you can have some credence and believe in it. But yeah, he believes in like, you know, he alkalines all his own, he drinks alkaline water, you know, removes all the impurities. And he was saying he only eats line caught wild trout.
Right.
So
nice, is it?
Yeah, it's beautiful. Has his own garden, grows all his own things. And all,
right.
You know, it's...
So he's,
it seems like he's making it work.
It was a healthy lifestyle.
I wouldn't knock it.
That then merged into this kind of... He says NASA is faking space photos. Have you chatted to him about this?
Not directly about the flat Earth, but I knew he was kind of... Like, he kind of hints at it within... I don't know. I actually really like him and talk. Like, within moments of meeting him, he kind of will hint at this kind of thing, you know? Conspiracy stuff.
Yeah. I enjoy talking to people about conspiracy theories. I just don't believe any of them.
I used to be deep into it as a teenager. Not as a teenager, like as an early 20s, you know, like when YouTube kind of first came around and, you know.
Was there a moon landing, Andy? Is that what you
said? I was never so much big into that. Like, remember that 2012, the Maya calendar and all that stuff. And that was all, it's just a bit of fun, isn't it?
Yeah, you know? Until it leads people to make bad decisions about vaccines.
Yeah, as long as it doesn't affect your life in a daily... I think it's just a bit of crap.
Yeah. Obviously, Frampton thinks it's real. So, he's still fighting?
Froch is retired. He's retired. Yeah, he's retired.
The fourth, years, three, yeah. So, he's now just a commentator, right?
Commentary, yeah. He's got a great lifestyle.
Yeah.
When you talk to him, he's still in great shape. So something's working there.
He's making it work for him.
Mm. He's a big poker player.
Oh, right, okay.
Yeah, he's like an ambassador for one of the poker companies and plays professionally and stuff.
Okay, right. Right, so obviously he still has all his mental faculties as well. Poker's a...
smart guy.
Tricky enough game.
Maybe the Earth is flat.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know.
I'm pretty sure it's not.
I've never been up on a... I've never really... You know, you look at Spain, you just see a spherical... I don't know. Tommy's agreeing with me.
Yeah, he's lucky he's not even paying attention. Right, the Irish news, what have we got for you this morning? Madden handed role with Tyrone. So former Antrim forward Kevin Madden has joined Tyrone's backroom team. He's going to become one of Mickey Hart's coaches. He spent 2 years previously as an assistant to the Derry boss Damien Cassidy. And at club level, he worked with the former Antrim boss Liam Bradley at Glenullen, winning a Derry senior football title back in 2007. And then Frampton, in line for Vegas date with Isaac Dogbo.
Dogbo's a former world champion, so it's a crossroads fight for both of those guys at this stage in their careers. But it was been touted like to be taking place in MSG in December 14th, so maybe it's going to be they're going to have their own card. I know Mike Conn is set to appear on that show on the 14th of December. Like, a little bit of uncertainty. I'm sure for Frampton at this stage in his career, like, he was supposed to fight in August. Do you remember
yeah,
this?
The thing fell
on his hand. Yeah,
yeah.
It wasn't kind of nailed down to the floor, this big pillar, like a granite pillar.
Yeah.
And, mad.
Yeah.
Just fell through a curtain and broke his hand. One of the most bizarre things. And, you know, there was a few question marks because people were kind of thinking because he was meant to fight in Belfast before and his opponent slipped in the shower and broke his teeth.
Yes.
Do you remember that one?
Yeah.
So people were thinking, like, question two times. This
yeah.
camp, you know, this is some sort of excuse, but he released videos and looked 100% like,
yeah,
actually this mad, bizarre thing happened. So his career's in a little bit of flux. Like, at this stage, he lost his last fight to Josh Warrington. But to come back and beat Dogbo would be a statement of to show that he's still at that top level. And he kind of needs that now at this stage. So
he could happily retire at this point, having achieved everything
he's
achieved, right?
Yeah, of course. Two-weight world champion. I'm sure he's financially secure with all of that as well.
Yeah.
But I think there's something else. I don't think his own words that he didn't do himself justice against Warrington, and I still believe he's better than he showed that night.
Yeah. He's a funny fighter in that sometimes he'll perform to the very top of his ability, but then when he comes down off that, he's very, very beatable.
Yeah, well, and I think for him it's a lot about the styles, you know. Warrington's a very awkward style, and when someone's being aggressive, which Dogbo would be, Frampton, it looks $1 million, you know. He's not an out-and-out counterpuncher, but when he's on the back foot and tricking and drawing people in, he really excels.
Right.
So he kind of needs that kind of a style, aggressive style, to make him look his best.
And if he wins this, is there another world title fight on the cards for him?
There would be, yeah. He's still a huge name. And he'd probably, having lost to Warrington, he'd be someone people think they could get at, you know. So,
yeah.
He has a lot of upsides to fighting him.
Okay, we'll talk about Tyson Fury in a couple of minutes, but it's a minute past 8 this morning here in OTBAM. Dundalk won the league last night. They beat Rovers 3-2, a game that they were always in control of, and kind of exactly what you want from the last game of the season. So, look at the rain. Miserable conditions to be winning the league title in. Miserable conditions for the snappers to be working in too. But yeah, so this footage from Jamie Moore, who was at the game last night. And obviously for Dundalk, this is proof that they can continue in the post-Stephen Kenny era with all their success. Jamie Moore is there. We're going to hear from Vinnie Perth and Rovers boss Stephen Bradley a little bit later on. It is their 5th title in 6 seasons, so congratulations to everybody from Dundalk. And it's amazing what they've been able to do. And really, they've kind of raised the standard that everybody else has to meet now in the league. So congratulations to everybody involved. Now, brilliant competition running this week on OTBAM with thanks to Expert Electrical, where we're giving you the chance to win a top-of-the-range LG 55-inch OLED TV, where you can watch the Rugby World Cup from the comfort of your own home in the best possible way. Some of the many features included are LG ThinQ AI, Google Assistant and Alexa. To enter the draw, all you've got to do is share OTBAM wherever you're watching this morning or listening to the show and tell us who won the 2011 Rugby World Cup. Expert Electrical is Ireland's largest retailer. And they've got the largest range of TVs and soundbars from all of the top brands such as LG, Samsung, Panasonic and Sony. You can shop online at expert.ie or you can visit one of their 67 stores nationwide. There's always an expert near you. It's 8:03 a.m. on OTBAM. We're talking boxing after these.
OTBAM. This is OTB Sports Radio.
The Sport Ireland campus, Blanchardstown, is the home of Irish sport, not just for our athletes, but for you in the community. Check out our amazing offers for families with kids' camps, sport academies and birthday parties. Or for adults, why not join our gym with a 50-metre pool? Or your club, school, friends can book one of our world-class indoor or outdoor facilities, including our athletics track, soccer, basketball or badminton courts, and many more. Check us out on Sport Ireland campus.
Join Bruce Betting now for a risk-free first bet up to €100. That's right. New Irish accounts can enjoy a risk-free first bet up to €100. So if your first bet loses, we'll refund your stake with a free bet. Now that's giving you more. Bruce Betting. In store, online, and now on your phone. T's and C's apply. Please gamble responsibly. See dunlewy.net.
OTB AM.
Okay, 4 minutes past 8 this morning. You're very welcome along. As ever, if you want to get involved, you can just use the hashtag OTBAM on our Twitter feed. Or, of course, you can always just leave us a comment on whatever stream that you're watching it on. So Andy's here with us. We thought we'd talk boxing. I wanted to start first with the Tyson Fury fight from a couple of weeks back. This was an amazing fight, really, to survive if you're Tyson Fury, although you're the favourite, like heavy favourite, and you're supposed to win, when you find yourself in a situation where the cut is so bad and so deep, like it's surely something that you are taking out of that fight forever.
I think he's kind of shown that he can overcome adversity. You know, I don't think he needed to prove that or even prove to himself, you know, that kind of way. In terms of he's been knocked down several times, you saw the fight with Wilder, he was like completely flattened, but this was a fight he was favoured to win, and again, similar to Ruiz against Joshua, people maybe have underestimated or written off his opponent completely. But Valen He's a tough man, you know, tough fighter. And he came to fight, and he had a very good man in his corner in terms of Joey Gamache, who's a 2-8 world champion, and Valanded. And it was a half fight, but like the cut changes everything, because up to that point, up to the, whatever it was, around 3 or 4 when the cut occurred, like Free was very much in control, and had the cut not happened, he probably would have boxed and been dominant for most of the going on for the fight. But because of the cut, he had to change his fight, take a different approach. But it really was a nasty cut, and it really puts a doubt on the proposed rematch with Wilder, which will be February 22nd.
So let's just play this, because we'll get to that in a minute. So I didn't know the rules actually here. So if it's a clash of heads and the fight gets stopped, it's a draw.
If it's deemed an accidental foul, like the cut was an accidental cut, whatever, it'll go to the scorecards after four completed rounds. So it was important for Fury to carry on winning, you know, the rounds. And there was some confusion, because in the corner that they weren't sure. It wasn't really clear, was it deemed an accident or not.
You know, if it's a punch, though.
If it's a punch, then...
And the fight gets stopped.
Which sounds crazy, because say it was deemed a punch, and the fight was stopped, like, and Fury had won 8 rounds, Otto Wallum would win the fight.
So if you call a stoppage of the fight because of a punch, you win.
Because of a punch.
Yeah.
Which sounds a bit wrong in some sense, doesn't it? I think it should always go to the scorecards, because of course...
That would make the most sense, wouldn't it?
I guess it's kind of thing like, like you said, I've caused this to stop. It's like a knockout in a sense, but like... And I would say that if this is not Fury in Vegas on a top-ranked card, anybody else would be stopped.
And maybe it didn't get stopped because of that rule where if it is a punch. So the Fury corner, you could hear this, where like, oh, look, don't worry about it. Just keep winning the rounds. Then if they stop the fight, it was accidental. It's not going to matter. But ESPN, who were covering the fight, went and checked with the Nevada commission who reviewed tape. And I think we can hear the audio.
I didn't know this.
You can have a listen to this now, I think.
And now there's a golden opportunity to hit the jackpot. Let's go back to Bernardo.
Ben, what is the impression of Tyson in terms of the position of the cut, and was it a headbutt or a punch?
Jorge's dealing with the cut. It's been deemed as a headbutt, so the referees told me. We did make the referee aware of that before.
Actually, it's been deemed a punch. The Nevada State Athletic Commission saw the replay, and they deemed it to be a clean punch. How does that change the outlook?
What's that, sorry?
Here we go. It's a punch. It was a clean punch due to the replay. How does that change the way you guys look at the situation?
Well, obviously Tyson's got to deal with it. He's got plenty of art, as he's shown before, so hopefully the referee gives him, understands that, and keeps him in the fight. But Tyson's dealing with it okay. He can box, he can see, so don't see why it should be a problem.
He seems to be pawing at it. How distracted is he, and how long till he gets back on track?
He's a little bit. He's on track. Even though he's been cut, he's still winning them rounds.
Thank you very much, Ben.
Stop.
So you see the confusion, because at first...
Yeah, so you do see the confusion. That's like the middle of the fight. They're it's grand, don't worry about it. It's like, no, hang on a second.
I was commentating on the fight, and I thought, oh, yeah, you know, just going off listening to the corner.
Yeah.
Because the referee never really made it clear, which they usually do. They were like...
I'd say he didn't know, did he?
I don't think so. I think maybe, by listening to that, the Nevada board overruled him and said that, you know, because there's this thing, you know, VAR is creeping its way into boxing now. Recently, there was a fighter, I can't think of his last name, I think it was Ruiz, who beat Charlie Edwards. This is like flyweights in London. Charlie Edwards was the champion. This guy came over, Ruiz from Mexico, no entourage, little guy on his own, but stops Charlie Edwards, knocks him down. While Charlie Edwards is on the floor, he hits him a body shot.
Right.
It was clear foul, but they announced the winner, Ruiz. He gets the belt, he's celebrating, does a post-fight interview. Edwards does a post-fight interview, and then WBC come in and say that everywhere else in the world we have VAR. And I've reviewed this, and I'm going to judge it in no contest.
Oh, no way.
Yeah.
Right.
So it was a really strange one, because they overruled with the British Boxing Board of Control, and then Edwards is in the ring, having lost, given like his kind of condolences and his kind of concession, you know, and then he's celebrating again because he hasn't lost his belt, and it was kind of weird. But yeah, Just back to Fury. Like, I thought he fought really well. There was an interesting, because Fury's dad was in London in the BT Sports doing punditry in the studio of BT Sports, and he was criticising Tyson's team in terms of his coaching and the people around him. And he said that if I was Tyson, I'd get rid of all of those guys because it's going to cost him his career. He looked weak as water. And pointed to the fact that Tyson had lost too much weight.
He lost a load of weight, didn't he?
Yeah, just the lightest he's been since he fought Klitschko.
Right.
But he's lost a huge amount of weight, obviously, because he blew up and was completely out of shape in that period of those 3 years where he was away from boxing. So it's an interesting time for him. Can he recover? Will his eye heal in time for him to make the rematch with Wilder? Which, if you listen to him, is signed and sealed. You know, Wilder has a fight. It's still not announced. A lot of speculation that it won't happen now. He's supposed to have a rematch of Luis Ortiz, which is a very dangerous fight. Supposed to be in November, but it's not been announced yet. And looking at what happened to Joshua and looking at what happened to Tyson with the cut, he might just say...
There's no point.
Yeah, pass that, give that a pass. But interesting time for Tyson. But regardless of all that, it was actually a really great fight. Vannon played his part and made it entertaining. Actually hurt Tyson legitimately in the last round.
Yeah.
And Tyson showed that he can win ugly, and gut it out. And a horrible, like, you can just on a practical level fight move, like, you can't with one vision and one eye and you're losing blood. And
did you get cut so much?
Several times. Yeah. It's always impede you, you know, in some way.
Did you just get better fighting with it, or did you never get better fighting with it? Like,
you learn how to avoid them and where to put your head in clinches.
Right.
But there's like an instance in this fight, and I don't know, it's done the rounds on Twitter and stuff, where the guy actually, while he's cut, puts his, like, inside of his glove into Fury's eye and rubs it like that, you know, and it was a nasty. Your man was quite dirty.
Yeah.
But Fury really did the business and did really well, so... hopefully he can heal up and we'll get that super fight.
We know America, like, you have to knock people out and you're supposed to be keeping doing that, but for whatever reason, maybe Tyson Fury is at that stage of his career where no matter what happens, he's still going to be a big draw in America.
Yeah, well, he did it last time, you know, and that was important, especially on his debut in America. Well, it wasn't his debut, but his debut in Vegas and on ESPN. And I think with the cut, it kind of puts, you know, I think people would give him a pass. It was a really entertaining fight.
And yeah, there's blood and guts. People are happy.
Love to see that.
Are you not entertained?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's all going well. Like this American kind of, I wouldn't say experiment, but this period of his career has gone to plan, it seems.
47 stitches to clean it up. So, I don't know how long that takes to heal, but, like, the plastic surgery these days is good. They should be able to, what are we at?
It's always going to be a weakness, though, for now, because it's going to be scar tissue there, which is always going to be weaker than actual, you know, normal skin.
Yeah. So if you're the Wilder camp right now, you're, like, practicing how to hit him in the eye.
I don't know if it's going that much, but if you're in the clinches, yeah, definitely put your head,
practice
your
head in there. Yeah. Probably easier to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. So where is that at the minute? Like, do you think that there is still three fighters at the same level, or has Anthony Joshua gone from that conversation until he reasserts himself?
It'll be interesting to see how his rematch goes, how it plays out. You could probably put Ruiz in the mix with him, maybe.
Right.
And Lewis, it's all about styles, isn't it? And the old cliche, styles make fights, but Joshua, if he's confident... Yeah, if he regains his confidence, I don't think he needs to change much as a fighter. Yeah, he could beat the other two, and they could beat him. Or they could have a situation where one beats one and one beats the other, but the other fella, you know, just how they all match up. They're all big enough, well, especially Wilder and Joshua, are big enough punches to end anyone's night with one punch.
Yeah.
So that's always an equaliser. But Fury is the best pure boxer out of the three of them, and if he can stay focused for 3 minutes a round... Well, box every one of them.
Is it possible that Joshua is just not as hungry as he needs to be?
Possibly. Or that, like, you look at his preparation for the Wild, for the Ruiz fight, I'm sure it's going to be completely different. Like, the amount of demand on him for that fight to promote it being in New York, his US debut,
yeah.
He was doing like interviews, and the fight was secondary. You know, he thought, you could see in his demeanor and his attitude that he thought he just had to turn up and beat him. And he almost did, you know. He almost did. He had him down and hurt. And then he comes back, goes in for the kill and gets caught himself. So it's a fine balance. You know, we could be talking about him having an easy win against Ruiz. And
this issue doesn't arise.
One punch and how it changes.
And so maybe the setback isn't the worst thing for him at this stage of his career?
Yeah, but it does put a lot of doubts. And look, he can't afford another loss. If he loses to Ruiz, it's kind of writings on the wall, isn't it? In terms of him being at that level. And in terms of him being this huge selling kind of machine, which he had become.
Yeah, and in fairness, that's the bit about the hunger. It's like, I've already made 40 to 60 million
that's
in my
it.
Life. Like, that's probably enough for somebody who started out going, maybe I'm going to make it, maybe I'm not. I don't even know the sport very well. Like, it's hard to maintain that. One last thing, Golovkin's fighting in a couple of weeks and Errol Spence Jr. next weekend. They're kind of the next big things on the radar.
Those are proper big fights, you know, like real boxing. Spence against Porter, two of the best welterweights in the world. Spence is in for a shout of being, well, he's not up there, but he's definitely in the top 10, maybe top 7 best fighters in the world, and he should beat Porter. He's just probably too young and too much for him. And then Golovkin versus Devchenko, which is an interesting fight because Golovkin at this stage has to prove that he's still elite, you know, still in the top 5 in the world. And Devchenko will be a test. You know, it will be a test. So, interesting times.
Okay, well, we might talk about them a bit closer to the time as well. I think we can head over to Hamamatsu in Japan, where Owen is hanging out. Obviously, that's where the Ireland team are ahead of the game against Japan this weekend. We're going to hear from the Irish press conference in a couple of minutes' time with Farrell and Kilcoyne are the two who are up today. So both might start against Japan. There's a good chance that we'll see plenty of changes. We'll go through those changes in a couple of minutes. We'll get into it here with Owen, who's talking with the Irish Independent's Rory O'Connor from just a few minutes ago.
All right, we have arrived in Hamamatsu. The first Ireland press conference of this particular leg of the trip is going to take place this afternoon in a little town a few miles west of here, I understand. It's called, or east of here, I should say, Iwata, it's called. It's about halfway between here and the match venue this weekend.
Yeah, and Joe Schmidt has spoken twice already about the hotel itself and how he's getting basically away from it all. Seems pretty thrilled by the venue and the fact that I think after a couple of days in the built-up areas in Chiba and then Yokohama, they're going and basically to a Japanese version of Carlton House. It seems to be a more traditional Japanese venue as well. We haven't been there yet. We might not actually get there at all because we're actually, you know, doing all the interviews and stuff at the training ground. But he seems delighted about it. Whether the players would be delighted to be cooped up miles away from anywhere remains to be seen. But I guess I think this whole tournament was always going to be really intense first 10, 15 days until the second match. And I think they'll be allowed to breathe a little bit after that.
It is intense more so down here when it comes to the weather. You step off the bullet train yesterday and it hits you.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's not as bad today, and I haven't looked at the forecast for the rest of the week yet. Last week was pretty much all weather-based. Hopefully, we're not talking about it as much. But it is very, very hot, or was yesterday anyway, because it was raining as well. So it just had that weird kind of sweat and rain. You're not sure which one is which. So it was, hopefully kind of today is quite a nice temperate day. I'm sure that'll be good for their training today. Be nice if it get a bit brighter. It's a bit dull out there. It's a bit grey, but it's going to be challenging. I mean, 6 days is, you know, and Japan played a high tempo. It will probably affect things on Saturday.
You were at Wales last night. How impressive were they?
They were good. I mean, it's hard to know how good Georgia were. I mean, Wales, the reason I went almost was just to see how Wales were getting on after all the controversy they'd been through with the Howley stuff. Whether there was a hangover, I mean, it was a bit of a kind of a Welsh version of Saipan, maybe on a lower scale. Within 2 minutes and 10 seconds, they'd scored, and they did it in such simple fashion that it begged the question, how good were Georgia at all? They scored 4 tries off first phase, which I suppose Rob Howley was probably watching from home going, well, they're all my moves, and they scored off them. And they were good. Georgia actually, after those 4 tries, grew into the game and played really well and drew the second half. And speaking to Graham Rowntree afterwards, he was saying, look, we're not a bad team, we just don't get to play enough tier one teams. So when we make these mistakes, we never get to learn from them, because it's 4 years before, you know, they played 4 tier one teams between the two tournaments. Wales very impressive. We'll know more on Sunday when they play Australia up in Tokyo.
Is that going to be another theme of this year's World Cup, that there's just going to be this massive divide between the tier one and the tier two teams? It's a story as old as time, but you're starting to see that perhaps the gap is actually growing, if anything else.
Yeah, it seems to be unlikely that there's going to be a shock at this World Cup. I think Japan against Scotland, you know, is that even a shock? They're at home. They've kind of developed. They are technically a tier two team, but they've had tier one preparation probably, and you know, because they knew this World Cup was coming, and they beat South Africa at the last World Cup. Fiji, if they had got that, if Australia had gotten Reece Hodge sent off, it might have been a different story. They show what they could do for 40 minutes, but again, they don't play enough games together. They don't spend enough time together. Their players are scattered across France and the world. It's very, very difficult for them. They don't have the structures. You know, there's protectionist markets in Ireland, Wales, Scotland that don't employ those players, you know, deliberately, unless they're willing to come and play for Ireland. You know, England has limited the access to players from abroad have because they want to have more English players. France are doing the same with the rules. It's getting harder and harder for players from tier two nations to get contracts and thus develop in that way, and then there's not enough resources in those countries to keep them together and not enough games, because Georgia are the best of the rest in Europe. They're the top of the tier, you know, they win that Six Nations B tournament every year. They came up against the Grand Slam champions, got blown away. They did a lot right. They scrummaged really well. They have their strengths like all of these teams. But we're going to see Ireland against tier two opposition in the next three games before that inevitable quarterfinal against South Africa. And really, you know, Japan aside, Samoa might give it a rattle. They always bring something to the table. They probably won't be troubled, and that's it's a shame because it is a World Cup, and you should have more than eight or nine really good teams. It should be more competitive than that.
Is it a case where Ireland actually have three experimental games now? Because one of the pieces of logic might have been two tough games and two easy ones, but actually it might be the case where Scotland might have been our toughest game at the pool.
Well, I think it was always going to be the toughest on paper, but with a six-day turnaround against the hosts, who are a good team, they're not a threat for winning the whole tournament. I think they could take Scotland out, and they've had 8 days to prepare. They'll feel that they're, you know, whereas the expectation last Friday night in Tokyo was on them, fully on them, and you could see that in the jitters. They'll feel that the pressure's on Ireland this time around, that they've, you know, obviously made a statement last Sunday. They're the number two ranked team in the world, and it keeps changing every week. But, you know, they're one of the favourites for the tournament. Everyone expects them to come out and do the same against Japan, which is a difficult thing to do in the circumstances. I'm not saying Japan will win the game. I think they will test them. But I think Russia will be a bit of a walkover. Samoa will be a physical battle. And I can see Joe Schmidt taking some frontliners out this week, freshening things up, putting them back in against Russia so that they get 60, 70 minutes, and then taking them back out against Samoa, because he'll feel that the squad can beat Samoa. But also, if he loses one or two players in massive collisions with big Samoans, he'd rather it was, say, Jack Carty rather than Johnny Sexton, sure, with all due respect to Jack Carty. So I think there will be... It gives them the leeway to be smart. They're top of the pool. They've taken full control. They've beaten the only real rival for topping the pool. And I think Scotland are now, you know, scrambling around. You know, two players have gone home. Hamish Watson and Ali Price. Two of their best players are gone. They're in absolute crisis mode, whereas Ireland can just sail through, rotating their squad. Even if they don't get bonus points, even if they're under par, they're still going to get there in the end and where they want to be. And they'll get a lot of game time shared around, so it's a happy camp.
So are you expecting that Ireland go with their first team this weekend, depending on who's available?
No, I think Schmidt has indicated that he will make changes. I think the fact that Rory Best went for 80 minutes on Sunday suggests to me that he won't start on Saturday, because, you know, why would you make a 37-year-old turn around like that? You know, he's got two good hookers there in Scanlon and Cronin. Why not use them? I think he could see, say, you know, Peter Mann, he might overcome all of his protocols. But why throw him out there when you've got Reece Ruddock there? Players like that, you know, does Johnny Sexton go again? I mean, they said it was a bang to the thigh yesterday. He got a lot of treatment around his groin area when he did go down. Do you take him out of the firing line, give Carberry, you know, 60, 70 minutes, or even Carty, who was very good off the bench, and bring Carberry in? He's got loads and loads of options, apart from in that kind of centre-back three area, where we still have, you know, we'll learn later on. Well, we'll get the official line later on what's going on, whether it matches up to reality, I don't know. But like Keith Earls did the warm-up on Sunday, so did Joey Carberry. Looks like they're fit, whereas Bundiaki, again, like Omani, do you risk him or do you pull him out and just give him an extra week? Even if he's clearing those protocols, just give him a break and bring him back in for the Russia games. And he'd probably be mad to play against Samoa because of the personal connection he has to that country. So, yeah, he's given himself the wiggle room. I think what we'll see is probably 10 of the team that started last week, four or five changes, something around those mats. He'll rotate it. A lot of players will drop to the bench and come in. It's just good squad management. He'll probably, like, say, Ryan, you know, Furlong, the younger players will probably back up. Some of the older players, maybe he'll look at, you know, giving them a rest.
But kind of a medium-term view, assuming that there's not going to be any fresh injuries. We talked about the three injuries last week, Kearney, Earls and Robbie Henshaw. To what extent do those three now have a battle in their hands to get their starting jersey back?
Well, I mean, they wouldn't have been too comfortable watching, particularly Rob Kearney, because I thought Jordan Armour did really, really well, did everything that was asked of him against a team that, you know, didn't play well but still probed with their kicking game in difficult conditions, you know, changed halfway through the game. He adapted. I thought Andrew Conway looked razor sharp, dropped two balls early on but grew into the game. Both looked like really, really strong attackers. And we've seen even that New Zealand-South Africa game on Saturday night, the small, quick players are having a good World Cup. And Keith Earls has that as well. I mean, Conway and Earls, you know, they play on the opposite wings for Munster, but they're competing for one spot here because Jacob Stockdale's automatically going to start. So I think Earls' seniority will probably get him back. I think Rob Kearney, it depends who you're playing against, but if you're playing against either the Box or New Zealand, or really any of the teams in those latter stages who have that really intelligent kicking game, he has an awful lot of credit in the bank. But Larmer's demanding in possession of the jersey, and he deserves to get another chance. And I thought it was interesting that Kearney didn't do the warm-up on Saturday, Sunday. That would indicate to me that he's behind the rest of them. Henshaw, I'm really not sure when we're going to see him. Mm. I mean, the sounds of things is that that's more serious. But Will Addison's picked up an injury back in Ulster, so the guy who was on standby is injured as well. Does that mean Dave Kearney's next in line? Is that why they're hanging on to him? Because they don't feel like there's any, you know, whereas Addison come in and cover five positions, they can't really bring Dave Kearney out, who's a bit of a specialist. So Henshaw's, they've all lost ground at the weekend because everyone gave a really, really good performance against a Tier 1 opponent. And that's really going to be the reference point going into that South Africa game in 3 or 4 weeks' time, because whatever happens in these couple of weeks, there will always be a bit of an asterisk about what they were up against, even though there was a bit of that with Scotland because they were so bad.
We've seen all the top teams play now at this point. Has your view changed on what the World Cup final is going to be?
Oh, I mean, I think I predicted England and South Africa, which is looking a bit ridiculous now. I kind of did that, and then I looked at what England have to do to get there, and they have to beat France, Argentina, and then win quarterfinal, semi-final and final. That's a very tough road to get there. I thought the Box were supercharged in that first 20 minutes and looked unbelievable, and I really thought they were going to blow New Zealand away, but it turned out they were basically putting an 80-minute performance in 20 minutes and punched themselves out, didn't get enough on the board. I wouldn't be writing them off by any means. I think Ireland have definitely reminded us of how good they are. You know, we've all been sucked into the just a bit of doom and gloom over 2019, but you know, completely understandably so. I mean, some of the performances were really poor. But I thought they hit back to that level. I mean, their efficiency in the 22 was really good, and there's opportunity to get much better. Their power game is back. Their forward play was excellent. They're so good out of touch. They're looking really, really good, Nick. So I think they're really contenders. Wales, we'll wait and see. Australia, I think they're all semi-final contenders without being necessarily the ones to win it. And then there's New Zealand, who I think are always the favourites. I just have a feeling they're going to be taken out along the way. And I thought Razzy Erasmus, in the aftermath of the game, said he reckoned that the Northern Hemisphere sides will ask New Zealand the questions that they don't get asked on a regular basis and might trip them up. And it could be England, it could be Ireland to take them out at some stage.
Right, very interesting. It'd be before a semi-final, though, or before a final, it'd be likely England at this point, right? If it was going to be New Zealand getting tripped up.
Yeah, I think it's England, looking at like an England semi-final, and then depending on whether Ireland... I have a terrible fear that Ireland will win a quarter-final and then lose to Wales in a semi-final. It's just, I think, the amount of emotion that will come out of having actually got there. Yeah. Then to turn around in a week and go again, especially against the Box, with all the focus. I mean, I think we're in day one of a 29-day build-up to this South Africa game. I mean, it's just going to be, like, by the time, I don't know what angles we're going to be got. Like, the last couple of days are going to be a real drag. But, I mean, with Razzy Erasmus, they've even called up another former Munster prop in Thomas Dutoy. There's now 5 ex-Munster people in their setup. I mean, it's just amazing. Like, as a storyline, it's to get your head around. It's great. It's going to be good fun. And I think Razzy's, you know, they're all dancing around it now. They're all, I think, when we go out there today, I have a feeling they're all going to avoid the questions about South Africa. But they'll know it's there. They'll know that's what they're building towards. And it's going to be fascinating if they get past that. I just have always hoped that if Ireland ever get past the quarterfinal, that they don't see that as the achievement, that they realise that if they take out the Box, I think it's the hardest quarterfinal they've had since 91. Mm. Like that, they can't fear anyone, you know. But anyway, that's way down the line. But I think Ireland have announced themselves as being legitimate top 2-3 in the world teams, as we saw in 18, and can go far in this current tournament if they can hold it all together.
All right, well, we are off to Ireland training this afternoon. You can read Rory O'Connor's work in the Irish Independent tomorrow morning, and we'll chat to you soon here on OTB AM. Thanks, Rory.
Cheers on.
Yeah, so pretty confident stuff coming from Japan.
It's but like, I was just watching, thinking like, think back to a few weeks ago, like when it was all doom and gloom. I think we're kind of setting us, I don't know. It's good to be positive. It's good to be confident.
It is, yeah.
But it could be setting ourselves up for a fall. And compared to, like, when you just... For me, as not, like, I wouldn't know the technicalities of rugby. I would just be, you know, passive... Not passive. Yeah, just a big game fan, you know, like, jump on the bandwagon at this type of event. But, like, when you look at the New Zealand and South Africa game, it was like they were playing in a different league, you know, almost like a different sport. It was, what you were looking, what you were seeing, but I think we, like, it's just Scotland, you know, we should just remember that it's just Scotland.
Yeah. And
they're an attacking team, and they don't, you know, they can see tries, and they're not,
the
you know,
wasn't
they're open, like, you know.
And the Scots papers have been saying it was the worst Scottish performance they can remember ever, and they've got some pretty bad performances in their locker that they're like, this is the worst I've ever seen from a Scotland team.
So,
you need to balance that out a little bit.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
All right, we got the thoughts of Brian O'Driscoll on yesterday afternoon on all of our social channels, youtube.com/offtheball. Of course, the podcasts are available wherever you get your podcasts. The best place to get our Off the Ball podcast at the minute is the Go Loud app. You can download it from the Play Store or the App Store. Here's Brian O'Driscoll talking about why he thinks Joe Smith has plenty to think about when all his back three options are available.
I think the two boys still have enough credit in the bank, Kearney and Earls. I do. But that gap has narrowed massively off the back of the weekend's performance as well. Mm. It's one thing doing it against Italy in Soldier Field, but you know, where Larmer scored a hat-trick, but, you know, doing it in a World Cup match against, you know, your toughest opponents in your pool, and standing up to every test asked of you and doing your basics brilliantly well, and working hard, I think they're all the attributes that Joe Schmidt absolutely loves in his players. And I thought Conway's really performed brilliantly in the last 5 or 6 weeks.
His form's too good to ignore at the moment.
It is. Yeah. And I've played with Keith Earls, and I've obviously played with Andrew Conway as well, but I've played with Keith Earls, and I've always felt as though the public have had an underappreciation for how gifted and talented he is. And I think we saw in the last couple of years what Keith Earls is capable of. He looks as though he has that Stockdale element, that it looks as though he's going to beat the first man every time. Very good defensively, very clever, reads it well, lots of experience in that regard, and he hasn't lost a meter of speed, or an inch of speed, I should say. But he's now starting to get under pressure because of the top quality performances of Conway.
Yeah, so plenty of options there all of a sudden in the back three when it looked like we were a bit bare. And the whole notion that Conway wasn't going to go to the World Cup as a talking point 4 or 5 weeks ago, in retrospect, was a bit ludicrous. So here is Brian talking about the prospect of Ireland beating the Springboks.
Are you now officially upgrading your Ireland prediction for this World Cup to champions?
I always said that we can win it. Sure. I did say we can win it. We need a lot to go for us, and I maintain that, that we need key individuals to stay fit. But one foot does feel as though it's in a quarter final.
Okay.
And there's a lot to be excited about. Mm. And that might be dashed in 80 minutes, but I think there's every possibility. One thing I do know, that there's some nervous South Africans out there now.
Yeah.
That they, you know, they looked at the performance, having lost to the Kiwis and then watched Ireland, they'll be thinking they really need to bring their A game, because Ireland like that will be a difficult proposition in a quarterfinal against them.
Which is about, you know, and that, you know, that's about fair enough. What you didn't want was this team to arrive, Ireland, I mean, and massively underperform, or for the wobbles of the earlier part of the year to continue in and everybody be saying, what the hell happened? Mm. At least now you can approach the rest of it with a sense that, well, they'll give themselves a decent shot here.
Yeah, and that's all you want. They've built for a number of years that they deserve a good shot at it. And if their best isn't enough against South Africa, you can genuinely hold your hands up and go, South Africa or some team. But I think if they play somewhere close to the standard they played against Scotland in a quarter final, they will push either of those Southern Hemisphere teams, and particularly South Africa, very close.
Yeah, okay, so that's Brian O'Driscoll speaking with Joe yesterday afternoon, streamed live on all of our social channels, of course. It is 8:35 a.m. this morning in Oaks VM. Mike Carlson is with us, to talk about the very latest in NFL. One last clip for you from Brian O'Driscoll. Yeah, so here he is on the prospect of, on the performance of Connor Murray.
And what were you seeing from Murray in particular?
With the exits, his box kicking was absolutely outstanding. A 20-metre gain on a box kick is pretty good going, depending on how, where the ruck is situated. But he seems to get every last sinew out of distance out of his kicks. And he doesn't drop them on the touchline. He drops them 4 or 5 metres into touch to discourage that quick line out as well. So he gives his forwards a breather as well. It seems as though they're nearly on the money every single time. And he hasn't had that accuracy over the last number of months. And I'm sure the injury was playing in his head, but it looks as though he's finally fit and feeling good and feeling free. And I think the knock-on effect is the rest of his game reverts back to type. I thought our exits after scoring each time were top class as well. You're at your most vulnerable, obviously, when you've scored because the opposition feels wounded and they ratchet up their chase and get after you. Whereas the ability to pick the ball, Farrell picked one on the third try above his head, lovely catch, set up, played a couple of phases, and then they either went from Murray or from Sexton. Sometimes cleared to touch, just kicked long on one occasion, and then just a good defensive line and forced Scotland into having to play or create something. Yeah. So I just thought that was a really concise part of their game that sometimes people take for granted.
Sure.
But if you get that right, and it reinforces the score. It almost feels like a mini score after, where you don't concede territory or possession immediately after scoring 5 or 7 points.
All right, more of that goodness coming your way a little bit later on. The Ireland press conference is on at the moment. Owen will be reporting from it for you a little bit later on, of course, on our social channels across the rest of the day. I want to go to the NFL, though. It was an amazing weekend of action and some important storylines off the pitch to talk about as well. Mike Carlson, good morning to you. How are you doing?
A bit wet. It's a monsoon over here, but otherwise I'm fine.
Yeah, we had it this morning too, but I think it's going to clear up for the rest of the day. So hopefully we'll send some good weather your direction as well. Let's talk about the stuff on the field before we get to the stuff off the field. There was some suggestions that maybe the Ravens weren't quite for real because they'd had two fairly easy games to start off the season, and that maybe Lamar wasn't a proper franchise quarterback just yet, even though he'd been anointed by anybody who saw the first two games. Then against Kansas City at the weekend, despite the fact they lost, he was actually still really good. So is it time to say that Lamar Jackson is the real deal?
I think so. And, they use him really well. Kansas City did a surprisingly good defensive job in that game and didn't give him a whole lot of opportunities throwing, managed to spy him. In other words, usually one defender was keeping him in line so that rather than rush straight at him as a passer, he would be holding off and try to account for Lamar Jackson being able to run. I think they can go a long way with him, especially with that defense that they've got. And they, in effect, held Kansas City into check. But, one of the big things in this game was down 11. They went for a two-point conversion, and everybody was saying, oh, why do you do that? Because if you don't make it, it means you have to go for a two just to tie. But John Harbaugh was explaining that they were playing for the win in that game. A two-point conversion would have meant that a touchdown and field goal to follow would have put them in the lead, would have given them the lead. He did not want to go to overtime with Kansas City. He was in a shootout with Kansas City, and he realized that that's not the game you want to play. If you can, if you're in the position to put points on the board, you have to. And that's the problem Kansas City are going to make for lots of teams. And the one question you might have about Lamar Jackson's performance or the Ravens' performance is to beat Kansas City, you have to be able to make big offensive plays. They have to come in. You have to either control the ball and keep it away from them, or you have to make big plays. And the Ravens just weren't quite able to control the ball probably for as much time as they would have liked to.
You mentioned the Harbaugh press conference afterwards where he talks about the mathematics and the analytics that go into making the decision to go for two at that point. And it's interesting because I think many people would have thought of Harbaugh, despite the fact he was one of the younger head coaches when he came into the NFL, as still being of the old school. Certainly his brother seems to be of the old school, where the analytics would have been kind of beaten back at the gate. We know football. We we know how to think, you can't tell us anything. It turns out he's not like that at all. He is actually trying to embrace that while at the same time surfing his gut instinct as much as he possibly can.
Yeah, I thought it was a great press conference. And, you know, their father was a football coach as well, so he grew up in football coaching. But, yeah, I think the key thing he said was teams have those charts. It goes back, Bill Walsh made one, as to when you go for a one-point conversion, when you go for a two-point conversion, depending on the score. But the key point is what I said before. You have to take the game context into account. And sometimes when you're playing a team like Kansas City, who can score from any part of the field, who can keep the game, the clock ticking, the points, the scoreboard ticking more than the clock, you have to take that into consideration and you have to adjust the charts, as it were, for the team you're playing. I just thought it was a remarkably cogent bit of analysis that everybody seemed to be agreeing with. All the analytics guys were kind of saying, oh, you know, this makes perfect sense. He's acknowledging us, but saying it has its limitations.
Yeah. Is there any room left in the NFL for coaches who aren't as smart as Harbaugh? Is the era of the coach who is saying no to analytics over?
You know, this is like an off the field discussion where there's always been a certain amount of analytics in football. It's probably the most analyzed game. You know, when you're looking at tape of every play and every practice that you have and watching everything that happens, but there's still a place possibly for the old style, angry, fire them up, rah-rah college guy, which is Pete Carroll to some extent. For example, not the mean Bear Bryant, Vince Lombardi type, but the rah-rah go. The problem nowadays, of course, is with young players and very rich players. It's hard to use the threat of losing your job, the threat of violence to keep guys in line. That kind of approach just don't work anymore.
We need to talk about Daniel Jones, the new QB at the New York Giants, who obviously replaced Eli Manning and was absolutely lights out, sensational, ran for two, threw for two touchdowns, that is, and which is rare enough from a Giants fan watching it over the last couple of years. They haven't seen any touchdowns, really. How the hell did he... like, this was one of the most controversial picks that I can remember anybody making in the last four or five drafts, where he was taken way too early. And now it looks like it was brilliantly prescient and a remarkable piece of draft work after one game. Obviously, small sample size.
Well, I mean, right now, after one game, there's two questions. One is Daniel Jones elite? And the other one is he a sure thing for the Hall of Fame now? You know, can we write him in now and forget about it? I was one of those people who liked Daniel Jones a lot coming out of college, but thought he probably needed some work. And the argument was never that he wasn't a first-round quarterback. It was that the Giants took him at six ahead of a couple of other players they could have used, most specifically Josh Allen, the pass rusher. And they probably could have had him at 17. But Dave Gettleman said, and it's hard to argue with, if you have a quarterback you really want, and he really wanted Daniel Jones, you have to take him at your first opportunity, because you just don't know if someone's going to sneak in ahead of you. You know, the Redskins took Haskins at 15. I don't think they probably would have taken Jones, but the possibility was there. He looked really good, and the impressive thing was that he settled down after that series of sacks that, you know, made him look like a rookie quarterback. He settled down and made some plays. And when you think about Pat Shurmur coming out of that Andy Reid kind of Philadelphia Eagles school of multiple layer offense, where you always see like tight ends coming across the field in the middle behind a short receiver and a deep receiver. If they had a deep receiver, that would be a dangerous offense. Of course, you know, somebody like, maybe an Odell Beckham or somebody like that, if they could have picked him up, you know, it's like that would all of a sudden be a dangerous offense again. Now, Saquon Barkley was hurt in that game, which is a setback if he's going to miss time. He was in an ankle boot at the end of the game. So we don't know about that, but it was certainly an encouraging performance. Although, remember, they should have lost that game. The rookie kicker for Tampa, Matt Gay, missed a 34-yard field goal, which was interesting because he made four field goals in that game, but he was 1 for 3 on extra points, and that kick was literally an extra point. It was almost exactly from the spot where you kick extra points. So I'm not sure what the problem is there, but I just had that feeling watching the end of the game that this is not a sure thing, this 34, which was a shame because Jameis Winston did a great job of completing two long passes to get them in position to kick that field goal.
Yeah, Mike Evans looks amazing. I want to talk to you about Antonio Brown, because it looks like the saga is finally over, certainly in terms of his NFL career. He announced on Twitter that he wasn't going to, that he was done with the NFL while taking shots at his former QB, Ben Roethlisberger, and also Bob Kraft, who was the owner of the team that he played for 11 days, saying that there were double standards with both of those people involved in the NFL, both of whom have had their own legal issues in recent times. And Antonio Brown now, it looks like, was probably going to be put on the exempt list, or it looked like something was going to happen that would have prevented him from playing. So I'm not quite sure what to make of all of this. And certainly the Patriots don't come out of it very well at the moment.
Well, I'm not sure about that, although the biggest story over the weekend was Bill Belichick not talking about it. He was doing a pregame interview as they walked into the stadium, and then the reporter said, I would be remiss not to ask you what the last straw was for Antonio Brown. And Bill Belichick said, we're here to play the Jets. And she said, oh, thank you, coach. And then he just looked at her for a couple of seconds. This was apparently, you know, earth-shaking news all around the internet. But the thing with Antonio Brown was he's got lawyers who have to be telling him to shut up. He's got an agent who has to be telling him to shut up. The Patriots, I assume, we don't know for sure, I assume said to him, just lay low, do not do anything else, and everything will be fine. And of course he didn't. When the next story came out about his doing the Venus on the Half show with the woman who was painting the mural in his house, he then sent this nasty tweet to her and other people, and, you know, asking them to investigate her and all this kind of stuff. So that was just, I think that was the last straw. It was the first straw. I think they had told him, you know, it wasn't a case of last straw for Antonio Brown with the Patriots. They had told him no straws. And when a straw came up, they let him go. And now, as you said, now that he's a free agent and he said, I'll never play in the NFL again, they can put him on the commissioner's exempt list, you know, without anyone accusing them of taking away his livelihood before any investigation decision has been made by the legal system. I see XFL written all over this guy. You know, when they launch next year, there's a chance for him to resurrect his career. But, you know, there will be more and more things coming up, and not just of the sexual nature, although nobody seems to pay much attention when it's not sexual. But this guy has stiffed more people than Donald Trump. He's got the chef he brought in when he rented a house for the Super Bowl for a week, and then offered, instead of paying him $36,000, he would mention him on Twitter a couple of times. And, you know, another person's come up saying that he's been stiffed. The woman who was painting the mural had been stiffed. But, you know, that's the kind of stuff that you can kind of get away with as long as you're not waggling it, you know, in front of people.
So I want to play that
clip. Or doing much worse. I'm not making light of what he's accused of doing.
No, of course, because there are unbelievably serious accusations leveled against him. Here's a clip from CBS when Belichick was asked about it, just for anybody who hasn't seen this or heard it.
I think I'd be remiss if I didn't ask, what was the final straw with Antonio Brown?
Yeah, we're focused on the Jets today.
Thank you, Coach.
Anna? It's the death stare.
I love that answer. She's so quick to give it. I had that pretty much word for word, didn't
you?
I
did, so
apart from the focused bit.
I heard Chris Wessling make this case on the Around the NFL podcast. His big mantra is, do your job. She's just doing her job. He knows that. Surely somebody within the Patriots who's on $1 million a year for PR, which I'm sure they have several of, are like, here's your line, just say this line and we'll move on. Oh, look, that's not a matter that we're willing to deal with at the moment. Something. Just like, she's doing her job.
Yeah, I mean, his line could have been, we've dealt with that, it's over. You know, that would have been enough. And I agree with you there. Although, having dealt with the Patriots PR department, they're a relatively defensive group. you know, they take the cue from the top.
Maybe.
And they don't give it. They're not going to give away information. Coming off the press conference on Friday after they released Brown, which was after their practice on Friday, so it was obviously a quick decision that they made. But there he simply said he read a quick statement about it and then refused to answer any questions. So of course, yeah, she's going to ask the question and he doesn't have to answer it basically, because, like I said, I think it's pretty obvious that that Brown, it wasn't a last straw for Antonio Brown, it was the first straw, and that's why he was gone.
The NFL has a long track record of giving people who have been accused of what Antonio Brown has been accused of, so long as there's no conviction, the opportunity after a 6-game ban or a 3-game ban or an 8-game ban to come back to the sport. Is that likely in this instance? Do you believe that there is a possibility that Brown's talent is so transcendent that, say there's an 8-game ban handed down for the end of this season, that next year somebody takes a risk on him, maybe after week one, so you don't have to go through any training camp drama?
It's always a possibility, I think, and that will depend on the results of the NFL's investigation as well as the result of the civil suit that's being fired. The interesting thing to me is that if you think about the civil suit, where Antonio Brown's story is that he didn't do any of the things, but he was accused of twice, what would you say, doing, what would you call it? They weren't attacks, but they were inappropriate sexual gestures by him with this woman who was his trainer. And then she, according to him, asked him for a loan. And then the following year came back, and she accuses him of rape. And he says that no, it was the usual consensual sex. And then he was sued in civil court for pretty much the same amount of money. So his defense was that this was a setup, that she came back a year later being all friends to set him up. But the setup only works if what she said about the first two accusations is true. If he hadn't done anything, there wouldn't be any reason to set him up. There wouldn't be any motive for her to have asked for the loan in the first place. And then, of course, what the second woman said, you know, about him standing naked with the hand towel over his private parts fits that scenario pretty well. You know, that here's a guy who has no idea of appropriate boundaries where he's concerned, but has not, except for this one accusation, has not been accused of physical violence at any point. So I think it's going to be a fascinating case for the NFL to investigate, because the second woman has not asked for anything. She's not filed any suits. She's not asking for any compensation. She just came forward because she thought it was relevant to the case. And I think that that's very true. And although I always have doubts, worries about the NFL existing as a parallel legal system to the legal system, I think since this is not a criminal case, it's a civil case, that the NFL does have a sort of duty here to investigate and come down to it. And I think what they will do in the end is keep him on the commissioner's list for the rest of the year. And if he were to come back next year, he would probably start that season with a suspension.
Yeah.
So they would announce that if he does play in the NFL, he's going to be under suspension for the first four, six, eight, whatever games it is. Much like the Kareem Hunt situation in Cleveland.
In a weird way, the fact that there isn't an ongoing legal case allows the NFL to make decisions in a way that they don't kind of have the shield of, we can't do anything until the actual legal situation resolves itself. So all of this is overshadowing the fact that the Patriots have started the season with breaking all sorts of defensive records already. So their defense is amazing, and Tom Brady is also playing lights out at the minute.
Yeah. I wonder, it's going to be a very interesting game for them this week against Buffalo, because Buffalo's defense is one of the best in the league. People don't realize that they were probably one of the top five defenses in the league last year, because their offense was so scattershot. And to an extent, it still is this year. But it'll be an interesting game, because the Patriots are playing with a makeshift offensive line. They have, with Brown gone, they don't have that much in terms of receiving. No tight end threat, no real mismatch guy to go against defenses. They try to run the ball, but Sony Michel has not really been effective in two of the three games they've played. So it's going to be on their defense, really, to create problems for Josh Allen, who, you know, we still think might be vulnerable to a lot of pressure, but also gets less pressure because, like Lamar Jackson, he's a guy you have to hold in the pocket. So you can't, your rushers have to be aware of him breaking the pocket and gaining a lot of yards running. I think that's going to be a fascinating game. The Jets, it was an amazing performance by the Jets, because the muffed punt touchdown and then the pick six touchdown off Jason Stidham covered the spread. they were 22.5 underdogs, and without scoring a touchdown offensively, they covered the spread, which had, I guess, an awful lot of bettors happy around America. You know, the level of applause there when in Foxborough when they scored the second touchdown was very strange indeed.
On that note, Mike, great to have you with us again. Thanks a million.
Oh, thanks, guys. Have a good morning.
Mike Carlson giving us some thoughts on the situation in the NFL. One more opportunity for you to enter our competition here. It's running all this week on OTBM, with thanks to Expert Electrical, where we're giving you the chance to win a top-of-the-range LG 55-inch OLED TV, where you can watch the Rugby World Cup from the comfort of your own home in the best possible way. So, the features included LG ThinQ AI, Google Assistant, Alexa, amongst others. To enter the draw, all you got to do is share OTBM wherever you're watching or listening to the show this morning and tell us who won the 2011 Rugby World Cup. Expert Electrical is Ireland's largest electrical retailer. They've got the largest range of TVs and soundbars from all of the top brands, LG, Samsung, Panasonic and Sony. And you can shop online at expert.ie or you can visit one of their 67 stores nationwide. There is always an expert near you. Right, so some Irish rugby news coming your way. Big lines from the latest Irish rugby press conferences. Richie Murphy, the skills coach, was speaking a little bit earlier on. He says that Johnny Sexton didn't train today. Peter Mahoney and Bundiaki have passed their HIA 3 assessments, so they would be available for selection this weekend. Robbie Henshaw is back running, which is good. Obviously, I don't know how comfortable or how fast he is, but he's back running. So I don't know what kind of time frame that leaves you when you've damaged your hamstring. More on offtheball.com from Owen Sheehan, and we'll have more on this after 9 o'clock this morning as well. Now, we did mention a little earlier on, Dundalk secured their fifth league title in 6 seasons last night. Here's their boss, Vinnie Perth, speaking afterwards to Jamie Moore.
So with Dundalk first team coach, no, head coach Vinnie Perth, title manager, what's the actual title? I need to remember, because it is the John Gaelic first team coach. You're head coach and you're a league winner, congratulations.
Yeah, but in all of that, don't forget Rory Higgins, he's the assistant manager, and I've been that soldier here for 6-7 years, and Rory is, you know, is forgotten about sometimes, fellas in that position, and he drives us, he's the one that gets the players going Monday morning, and ultimately this is it. This has always been about the group, and we've lost a lot of big names out of the group over years, like Tell, Finn, Boyle, Horgan, and we've just kept going, and the group has been brilliant this year, and they deserve all the credit.
We're probably an hour and 15, an hour and 20 after the game, Vinny. You've done lots of media. Have you had a chance yet to speak to the players, speak to the staff, say well done?
No, not really, you know, other than hugging it out with them. I suppose a phone call from home, and that's the only phone call I've sort of taken, and very emotional that, you know, friends and family are, for them, it probably in one sense means more, because they know how hard I have to work to achieve my goals. So, really, you know, special night for the group. And yeah, I want the players to celebrate tonight, and they have to enjoy these moments. And I'll hook up with them shortly. But, you know, we'll get back to work then, unfortunately, tomorrow ahead of a big game on Sunday.
What does it mean to you, Vinny, to have led the team to the league title and the EA Sports Cup with a cup semi final to come on Sunday?
Yeah, listen, I suppose, as I said, it's more about friends and family. They're the ones that know how hard you work. Like, I was on the hill up in Sacred Heart not that many years ago coaching, because of when I played, I came out, and when you're not a big name player, you have to do it the hard way. So I suppose it's probably great for young coaches and coaches at a lower level to say, geez, if that fella can do it, maybe I can. And I hope it inspires a couple of more coaches, and ultimately it's about Irish football getting better, and I hope people, you know, if it's 1B Leinster Senior League, or when I went to Malahide at Division 1, they look at that and say that could be a route for me as well. So I hope this inspires, for want of a better word, other people to feel they can achieve ultimately what I've achieved as you know, the manager of this club.
Yeah, so congratulations to Vinnie Perth and everybody else involved in another great win for Dundalk, the dominant force in Irish football. 5 league titles in 6 seasons, pretty amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, and like you said, they're setting a new standard for the rest of the teams, and the consistency is remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah.
Even though there's been a lot of change with the manager and the players in and out, it's...
I think ordinarily, if one team wins 5 out of 6, everybody's going, ooh, there's a problem there. But actually what they've done is raise standards, and they've set a benchmark that other teams can kind of aspire to.
And the fact that it's always changing, that it's changed over the years, that they've lost big players, but they can continue to win, shows that they have some sort of formula, or there's something there that they're doing right.
Yeah, something good in the DNA. It's bang on 9 o'clock this morning, this Tuesday morning. You're watching OTBAM. Will Shane Duffy struggle to get back in the Brighton team? Stephen Doyle spoke with Gary Breen after they called West Ham's win against Man United on Sunday that was live and off the ball. Have a look.
It's a challenge for Shane. And if I think of all the challenges that have been put in front of that young man, he's took them on. He really has. You think about a bad injury he got, gets into the Ireland squad at a time when you're thinking he's just making his mark. Instant impact. Similar to in terms of what he did at Brighton, goes into the Premier League, does that again. So this is another challenge. Now, we don't know, but he's got to make a decision based on the fact that I think he'll take the challenge on in terms of what I know of him. I don't know him personally. I can only judge him what I'm seeing. I think he'll take that challenge on. But he may well look at the scenario and think, well, listen, no matter how well I play, I'm not going to get the nod. And effectively, if they're playing three centre-halves at Brighton at the moment, as they are doing, in contrast to two last year, at the moment he's fourth choice. Now, he may well have a decision to make. But if you're asking me, is he the type that takes that challenge on and says, I'm going to prove you wrong, I'd say absolutely he is. And he's been magnificent for Ireland. And although he may not be getting his game, not for one moment will Mick McCarthy be worried about that. He'll be nailed on to start Ireland's games.
What is it just about Graham Potter and the way he plays, the way he wants his team to play? Why do you think it is that Shane is starting to be left out now?
I think ultimately because it's more expansive, they like to play it from the back, it's through the thirds. And if you think about Shane's strengths, that's probably not one of them. Mm. But don't underestimate how important it is to have a centre-half, who I've just mentioned earlier, that dominates that area in front of his goal, which he does.
OTB AM on OTB Sports Radio, Ireland's first and only sports radio station.
The Sport Ireland campus, Blanchard's Town, is the home of Irish sport, not just for our athletes, but for you in the community. Check out our amazing offers for families with kids camps, sport academies and birthday parties. Or for adults, why not join our gym with a 50-metre pool? Or your club, school, friends can book one of our world-class indoor or outdoor facilities, including our athletics track, soccer, basketball or badminton courts and many more. Check us out on Sport Ireland campus. Campus.ie.
Join Bruce Betting now for a risk-free first bet up to €100. That's right. New Irish accounts can enjoy a risk-free first bet up to €100. So if your first bet loses, we'll refund your stake with a free bet. Now that's giving you more. Bruce Betting. In-store, online, and now on your phone. T's and C's apply. Please gamble responsibly. See Dunlewy.net.
OTB AM.
The mood is definitely different at games to online. It's totally different. The fans are supportive, they're patient, maybe to a fault, in that they'll back the person who they can see in real life 50 or 100 metres away from them. And Ole Gunnar will benefit more from that than most because of his legendary status at the club. But the fans are not stupid either. They want to be entertained. They work hard to pay for the season tickets. They're paying between £500 and £1,000, which these days is €500 and €1,000. To watch Manchester United, and if it's dull, it's dull. That's what did for Van Gaal. That's what did for Mourinho. The fans will not accept a defensive formation at home against Crystal Palace. And there are all these stats when Van Gaal was there of people who say, I sit in the scoreboard end, I've not seen a goal at my end for 7 months. Just stuck with me. So it was funny.
Yeah.
And if the football's not entertaining, then the discontent will start to build. There's so many factors you can put into whether a manager stays popular or not.
Yeah.
And the club, little things like today, they're gonna look at bringing Safe Standing in. That's great. If the women's team are winning, that's great as well. But the results of the first team overshadow everything. If the team are playing well and they're losing, or they've drawn at West Ham yesterday, people will accept that. They're not expecting a league title this year.
Yeah.
And some of the fans don't help as well, because some of them, whether they like it or not, were only attracted to the team that were winning. And football teams do not always win. No team in history has always won. And this is the uncomfortable truth. Now is that the team has stopped winning. But in the 80s, when I started going to games, it wasn't a winning team. It wasn't a team that went close to winning the league.
Sure.
But I supported them.
Andy Mitten, getting to the very nub of the issue that a lot of fans have. Everybody wants to be on the side that's winning.
Mm.
It's interesting now that Man United have gone through this period that Liverpool went through, that like all the great teams have gone through.
But it's been allowed to go this way is the thing, isn't it? When you've been on top for so long.
All empires get complacent.
Yeah, I don't know what it is. Like, obviously, the appointment of managers is the big thing. And like, David Moyes wasn't
a bad idea.
Yeah, Well, it's just, you look at throughout the papers this morning, there's like the wimps. There's a piece with Warren Matt. He talks about all the different coaches he's been with, and there's like the wimp percentage. David Moyes is, you know, it's not that bad. He's behind Mourinho, but he's done all right. It's just, I don't know, it was his demeanor. But it is what Andy Mitten said there. It's the style of play that that United fans, not the United way, the attacking, you know,
yeah,
counter attacking team and entertaining play.
We talk about this a good bit, and it's clear that the owners of the club don't really care how well or otherwise the football team are doing. They care about the profit and the bottom line, and then they hire managers who they think are famous as opposed to good, and those famous managers spend money on famous players, and this cycle continues, as opposed to, well, we're going to buy a bunch of players who are going to play in a particular style, and that's our philosophy, and we're always going to have that philosophy here because we are Man United. They haven't been able to do that. Maybe Solskjaer can get them back to that, but notwithstanding, it's interesting that there are some fans.
But Solskjaer's never, like, I'm not sure, like, I know he hasn't got much to prove that he can do it, though. Like, he's never done, like,
no,
you know.
No, he hasn't.
But, like, after he left Hull, Marco Silva came and kind of showed him up a little bit. You know, they weren't winning matches, but they were playing a lot better. And, like, he was getting beaten with Cardiff. It was, like, you know, it's just different. Like, it was just, I don't know. He obviously had that big upturn when he came in. There was that feel-good factor, but it was
pure
maybe,
emotion.
Yeah, you know.
Fluke. It felt fluky, but I'm interested in that thing about the Man United fans being, some of the Man United fans were glory hunters. Every great team, every winning team gets a bandwagon element. And maybe the right thing for that bandwagon element is to disappear. Like, maybe they should disappear.
I know. Well, it's hard to, like, what, I will not serve that in which I no longer believe. You know, it's hard, isn't it? It's hard to follow a team that doesn't represent you in a way, like, because that's how I'm kind of defending myself. And from recently being switched off from football, you know, when they were winning everything, I was keen as mustard. But now, I have to admit, it's hard to watch. You know, it's hard to watch them lose 2-0 to West Ham and never really create any chances or look like ever winning a match. So, I don't know. Like, it's just, and it's more of the direction of the club is going for. Like, given De Gea a contract, you know, a new contract, what's it, $400,000 a week. And he's not a leader. He has been a great player, the best player for a long time. But recently he's probably slipped a bit. Or I'm not sure if he cares as much as he just resigned to saying, I'm going to be here forever, I'm never going to go to Madrid. And I'm just going to play a part now.
Yeah.
You know, that his aspirations are not. Well, yeah, like they have Henderson, who's a Sheffield, he's on their books, he plays for Sheffield, he's doing a good job, and Romero's a good keeper.
So you think they could have got rid of him and
given,
send a message
given that
to everybody.
Much money, you know? I don't know. And it's just, I don't know, a lot of criticism for Woodward, but, like, even buying Harry Maguire, like, you know, it's. He's not Van Dijk, you know. Like, as much as I hate to say it, you know, like, there's a huge difference between those
two.
And like,
same money, roughly.
Yeah, and I'm sorry, just like the bargaining, like, and the negotiating. Leicester set the price. They carried on for 6 weeks negotiating, and then they give Leicester the price they want, if not more. Like, you know, so like, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. I want to move on because I'm delighted to say we've got Scott Fardy. We're gonna give him a couple of minutes. Sorry. All right. Yeah, sorry, it looked like we did. Here's one more from Andy Mitten on whether Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is still popular in the Man United dressing room.
You often have a sense of how things are behind closed doors in so much as anyone can. What's the feeling on Solskjaer amongst the squad?
He's still popular. He's a popular, hard-working, decent human being who's not spreading poison around. I saw that stat. I wrote that stat myself soon after the game yesterday.
Right.
Because I've been at these matches, and a lot of them have not been pretty. The end of the season was terrible. It was as bad as PSG away was good.
Mm.
And it is relegation form if you take the form from the 6th of March, although it was title-winning form if you take the form from at the start of the year. Ole Gunnar's popular. He's got good coaching staff around him. And there's a belief that he knows what he's doing. He needs to be supported. He's under a lot of pressure, as anybody would be. It's a huge job for any individual person, and he tries to share the load. Got good people around him with Kieran McKenna, Michael Carrick, Mike Phelan. He's amenable with the media. He can be ponderous sometimes with the media, but I think he's a straight person. He answers questions. I don't think he's not built up a bank of credit where he can start manipulating media. I think he's just got to play a straight bat at the moment and speak well of players who he needs to be on side, because this is a United squad, which, if anything, is lacking. He can't start alienating his players. He's strong behind closed doors when he needs to be. He's not a soft touch by any stretch. He was brought in and asked to lift the mood, and he certainly did that. But it all boils down to results. Mm. You've got to win football matches. It's that simple. And when you don't win football matches, this negative lens goes over absolutely everything.
Yeah, results dictate everything. Phil is here. Phil, how are you?
Very well, yeah. I see we got the brief about wearing navy today. not great for people listening. But only one place to start: Dundalk. SSE, Airtricity League Premier Division champions, 5 titles in 6 years, and there's a chance they could win a treble, a domestic treble. Derry City, the only League of Ireland club to win a domestic treble, they did that in 1989. But Dundalk wrapped up the league title with 4 games to spare, with a 3-2 win against Shamrock Rovers at Oriel Park, 2-0 up at half time. Sean Hoare and Robbie Benson with the goals. Aaron Green pulled one back for Rovers 10 minutes into the second half, but the goal of the game then came from Michael Duffy, a cracking goal into the top corner. So Dundalk then 2 goals ahead again. Aaron McInniff scored a second goal for Rovers with just over 20 minutes to play to make it a tense final 20 minutes. But Dundalk saw the win out. That's 14 top flight titles, and their next game is against Sligo Rovers in the semi-finals of the FAI Cup, which is on Sunday. Obviously Rovers back in action on Friday night when they go to Dalymount Park to play Bohemians in the first of the Cup semi-finals. Barcelona's Lionel Messi took home the Player of the Year award for a 6th time at the Best FIFA Football Awards in Milan last night. The USA's World Cup winning captain Megan Rapinoe won the Women's Player of the Year award, while Liverpool manager Jurgen Klopp was named Coach of the Year. I think one of the interesting aspects of these awards is who all the players voted for. You like to see, you know, their tastes, and Messi went for Sadio Mane as number one. He had Ronaldo in 2nd place, which, that's a nice touch.
Yeah.
Ronaldo, do you think he'd reciprocate?
No.
Not a chance.
Not even top 3, was he?
No. He went for Matthias de Ligt, his new Juventus teammate, as number 1. Then he went for Frankie de Jong and Kylian Mbappe. Like, Ronaldo's playing the game here. He realises, I can't give him a vote. Ireland captain Seamus Coleman went for Messi, number 1. Virgil van Dijk, number 2. And Ronaldo in 3rd. Mick McCarthy, there's no way he was looking past a commanding, towering centre-half. So Virgil van Dijk got number 1. Then he went for Frankie de Jong. I'm convinced it's because he must have seen him play in the Dutch Cup final when he went over to watch Daniel Crowley, the game that Crowley was actually on the bench. But Mick said, I actually really enjoyed watching Ajax play. So I think that's probably where he saw
20 years ago.
And he went for Harry Kane in 3rd place. The big boys step into the 3rd round of the English League Cup tonight, so there's going to be plenty of changes to the various starting 11s, but that could be good news for a couple of young Irish players. We'll probably see Caoimhín Kelleher make his debut for Liverpool tomorrow night against MK Dons, but Troy Parrott, teenage striker, could be handed a competitive debut for Tottenham, who are away to Colchester. Holders Manchester City go to Preston. Arsenal host Nottingham Forest. Everton are away to Sheffield Wednesday. Some of the other ties to look out for: Portsmouth and Southampton. Watford play Swansea, and Luton face Leicester. All those games kick off at 7:45.
All right, Phil, stay with us because we're going back to Japan, and I'm delighted to say we're joined by Scott Fardy all the way from Kamashi on the northeast coast of Japan. Scott, good evening to you. I believe it is there now. This is obviously an emotional week for this town. We were talking with Alan Quinlan, who's there yesterday, and he was just giving us a bit of the background about how this is kind of rugby heartland for Japan, and it was also one of the areas most devastated by the tsunami in 2011. I guess it's an emotional week for you to be back there as well.
Yeah, thanks for having us, guys. Yeah, it's a nice evening here in Kumasi. It's a rugby heartland of Japan, and such a small place to be hosting a game at the World Cup, and the whole town's just really pumped and really excited about tomorrow and looking forward to it. I've seen more foreigners today than I have my whole time that I lived here. There's not usually many foreigners in this part of Japan, but to see as many people come up to watch this game is really exciting.
How did you end up as a foreigner in Kamachi? What was your origin story?
Yeah, I just was like, before I played for the Brumbies, I couldn't get a super deal, and I took kind of my last contract on offer in Japan. I was 24 when I came over here. It's kind of a small town in kind of middle of nowhere, Japan, and ended up staying here for 3 years. And it's very traditional Japanese. Absolutely, you know, no kind of foreign influence up in this part of the country. It's full of great people, and I made some great memories here over the 3 years that I was here.
That must have been a fairly amazing experience for a 24-year-old to go, because obviously, in terms of culture shocks, I imagine the culture shock from Australia to Japan is as big as any culture shock that you're ever going to have.
Yeah, I think Australia to Tokyo, it's probably not too bad. In Tokyo, you've got everything. And you take times out again when you go up to the rural areas of Japan. It's you know, a totally different country again. And there's not much English up here at all. Like, you wouldn't know English menus or anything like that. So you get those in Tokyo, but not up here, so... You have to adapt pretty quick, but I was lucky to be surrounded by some really good foreigners and play alongside here, and also some amazing Japanese players that, you know, took me under their wing for the time that I was here.
So you'd been there already a couple of seasons, I think, by the time the tsunami hit. Is that right?
Yeah, so I came here in 2009 and played the 2009-2010 season, and then was here for arrived about 2 weeks into arrived at the start of March for kind of pre-season, the longest pre-season training you can do. So it goes from about March to September, your pre-season. But, 2 weeks in and the tsunami hit here in, obviously, the big earthquake, and then the tsunami hit on March 11, and the rest is history there. And it destroyed the whole front of the town. Where the rugby ground was quite safe. It's a fair bit back into town, so we're all pretty safe in that way. Just lost power, and there's you know, the kind of food rations and those things, and, you know, the place was an absolute disaster zone, but I didn't suffer in any way, but a lot of people here, you know, really went through some tough times.
Yeah, so when the earthquake itself hits, is there an immediate recognition in the area that, like, if an earthquake this size is going to hit, then a tsunami is a real possibility?
Yeah, well, there was, as soon as the earthquake hit, the warnings went out over the loudspeaker, so, you know, compare that to probably the Boxing Day tsunami, where there was just no warning for people, you know, and that was probably saved, you know, countless lives from that. Because, you know, as soon as the earthquake hit, the tsunami warnings were blasted through the town, and you were everyone was off the high ground. And so obviously, a few people couldn't get away in time.
It was a fairly horrific loss of life. I think about 1,000 people died. So we're 10 years on, nearly now, 8 years on from that happening. The recovery effort, the emotional toll that it takes on the place. That, you know, I'm not sure anywhere ever really fully recovers from a natural disaster like that. But what was the aftermath like then?
Yeah, well, we kind of, you know, we ended up staying around, and you know, probably a lot of foreigners left Japan at that time. Remember Tokyo, you couldn't get a flight out of Tokyo. People were leaving so quickly, especially with the Fukushima stuff going on. But we kind of stayed around. We're, you know, a small rugby team up here, so we're pretty tight with the community. We end up doing a fair bit of work here, and just kind of unloading trucks and, you know, kind of preparing, unloading food trucks were coming from all over Japan that people had been donating to people up here, and tried our best to help out where we could as a team kind of thing. And we ended up, as we stayed here for longer, and then they kind of, the people of the town wanted us to get back and start training and start preparing for the season. And then we became, for that year, essentially a bit of a symbol of the symbol of hope and of new beginnings kind of thing for the town. You know, they've really embraced that. And on the back of that came this opportunity to host a rugby game. And, you know, the whole town has been really, like, so excited about that. It actually used to be Nippon Steel, who was my employer when I was here. They sponsor the team here, so it's different. It's not a company team as such. It's actually a community team. And the Nippon Steel, they were actually like a seven in a row, eight in a row. They won the championships in Japan in the 80s or 70s and 80s. So they had a real long history even before the Kamoshi Seaway started.
That season, what was the actual season like for you guys then when the rugby starts back and the community does see you as a symbol of hope?
Yeah, I guess it was, you know, it was all very emotional, and, you know, guys within the team had grown up in the town, and, you know, guys had lived in the town for a long time. I was with former All-Black Peter Altini. He'd been in the town for 6 years, you know, at the time, so... You know, he was, you know, his kids went to school there, and everyone was very well connected, and, you know, very connected to the town. So, yeah, emotion, the first three games especially were very emotional kind of games. You know, the crowd was right into it. You know, get big crowds, and we actually had quite large crowds for second division Japan. You know, it was, but you know, it was something that brought us as a team really close together. You know, we got. You know, we were a really tight group, even foreigners and Japanese were very tight.
It's definitely something that probably takes everybody a little while to process what the impact is, just even on a personal level of kind of living through a situation like that. Because it sounds like the team immediately kicks into this kind of spirit of the Blitz. This is, you know, a very difficult situation for everybody, but we can do something to help. Maybe it's 6 months later or 12 months later where you begin to realise that you know, you've lived through a fairly significant natural disaster.
Yeah, like I think it. Look, you're in it. You kind of. I didn't realise until probably a few days after the tsunami how, you know, we kind of lost power. So, you know, people were getting the footage of the waves hitting the coast, and we weren't getting those. We just were kind of on the other end of it inside the disaster zone. So we weren't aware of how big it was in terms of worldwide news because. You know, you weren't connected. We all lost internet, lost power for a week or so. So, we probably didn't realise at the time that, you know, how big the tsunami was and how much of it was a big global moment.
Yeah, and obviously it had such an important impact in your life. You're back there this week to make sure that you're there for the game. It's Fiji against Uruguay. It's on tomorrow. You've taken the week off to go back to Japan.
Yeah, I was thankful to get the opportunity to come back. I think you know, Leo was obviously really supportive of it and said, you know, go for it. And it was just a shame when it was in the middle of the week and I had to. But yeah, I'm just lucky that I'm able to come back here and, you know, see the changes that have happened here. And, you know, the town has changed so much since those eight and a half years ago now. It's almost unrecognisable. And so many people have done so much hard work to get it looking what it is now. You know, if you were to see a photo of this of the town 8 years ago, you know, you couldn't believe what it is now. So it's a credit to all the people of the community here, the Japanese government and everybody that were able to rebuild and obviously even in some cases make it even better than what it was before.
Well, Scott, enjoy the week in Kamashi and we hope to see you back in the Letter Shirt real soon. Thanks a million.
Yeah, thanks very much, guys. Have a good week. Back there soon.
So Scott Fardy joining us live from Kamashi. I didn't realise when we were making contact with him, we knew he'd been there, but that he'd come back over for the week. I don't know if you ever really processed the fact that you've lived through something like that.
No, incredible. But probably nice for him to go back and kind of just walk those streets again and, you know, I bring back a few unwanted memories as well, but I'd say it's more positive than anything.
Yeah. Yeah, so I'm going to be interested in that game between Fiji and Uruguay now tomorrow. Kicks off at 6:15. We'll at least be up for it, unlike some of the other weekend games, which I'm not sure I'm going to be getting up for.
You didn't make it up for the Australia-Fiji game, though?
I didn't. Watch that on replay later on in the afternoon.
Yeah, I think our ones are a lot better.
Just about, yeah.
We got a good time slot, didn't we, the weekend as well.
Japan's 8:45, is it?
8:15. Yeah.
That extra half hour I've imagined myself. You can record it now, though. I'm going to...
Yeah. It's never the same, though.
It's not the same.
It is once you don't know it.
I know, but it's
very
hard.
You should know this from boxing.
I know, but
it's hard.
You can't watch what's happening, the analysis on Twitter and go, what happened there? Somebody's screen grabbed something or gifted it or whatever.
Yeah, you have to say off social media and just watch
which
it.
Is a pain in the ass. Can't do that. But ridiculous to what are you talking about?
Do you think... I do think, like, it's obviously it's always this debate, like, are you watching your phone or are you watching the game? You
know, watching your phone, it turns out.
But, like,
it does enhance the game, the sport you're watching in some way. You know, the online commentary.
Yeah.
The...
Depends what game or what sport, because something like rugby, there's plenty of breaks in play where you do have a chance to, like even boxing, in between rounds.
I know.
You want to see. Yes. Who'd you give that round to? That kind of thing.
Yeah, I never. That's no. Not something you should do. Don't go with the flow.
No.
The group flow.
Like, obviously, you've marked your score down for the round. You've submitted to the referee already.
Yeah. Just to go back to when that tsunami hit in Japan, I was the day before, the morning of when I fought Craig McKeown.
Right.
Yeah. And I remember watching it in my hotel room alone, and it was like, it was mad. But I know it's, to put it in a real put, like, obviously, it was a terrible disaster, but... But you put things in perspective for me, because this fight, you know, at that time I was thinking, like, this is life and death, you know, going into it. But then I realised, geez, look what's happening. You know, this is nothing. This is nothing to be worried about.
How did you get on that fight?
Barely won. I won, but just barely, yeah. Barely.
Was that not one of the later round knockouts?
Yeah, it was. But I was losing up to that point, so.
But hang on, so that barely won is not the correct. It was like, I had a stunning... come from behind knockout.
Yeah.
That's the more accurate. That's the better way of selling that one, isn't it?
But hanging in there for a long
time. I remember watching that, yeah. Yeah. It wasn't quite, like, it wasn't as, like, you weren't in desperate need of a knockout, though.
I thought it was.
Yeah?
Yeah. And then at the time. Anyway.
It wasn't much. I'd be interested in the scorecards, but it didn't seem like there was much in the round, so.
That earthquake, by the way, lasted for 6 minutes. Can you imagine the terror of, like, most earthquakes last 10, 15, 20 seconds?
You're thinking, like, when he's describing it there, what would you do if it ever happened now? Like, here, what would you, where would you go? I was thinking, run to the school, pick up the kids, run to the highest tower block you can find, get to Highland. What do you do?
Yeah, I don't know. Tower blocks are all danger of collapse as well, so.
Mm.
Yeah, pretty grim.
Bit of... injury news from the Ireland camp. Obviously, Ireland played Japan on Saturday in their second pool A game. We know Johnny Sexton didn't train. He picked up a leg injury against Scotland. Management are hopeful he will resume training on Thursday, which would suggest he won't play this weekend. But I think that comes as a major surprise, considering Joey Carberry did train fully, as did Keith Earls and Rob Kearney. Also, Peter O'Mahony and Bundy Aki were part of the training session. Both have passed their head injury assessments in full. Robbie Henshaw trained away from the rest of the squad. He's continuing to recover from a hamstring injury, so he's going to miss out again this weekend. There is a game in Ireland's pool this morning. Russia and Samoa meet at 11:15. And England head coach Eddie Jones has named his team for Thursday's game with the USA. 10 changes from the win over Tonga. George Ford will captain the side. Elliot Daly, Joe Marler and Billy Vunipolo also kept in the team. And Rory McConachy is going to start on the right wing. He only made his England debut earlier this month.
All right. I would expect Ireland to make fewer changes, but I wouldn't be terribly surprised if there was a whole heap of changes.
How many are you thinking?
Five at least.
You're looking at, obviously, like, Murray's probably going to start again, isn't he?
Yeah, I think so. If Sexton doesn't start, you start with Murray, right?
Sarah Murray makes things easier for whoever starts it out half.
Yeah.
You want your first choice scrum half making the out half replacement that bit smoother.
Yeah, and so Sexton doesn't start. The two lads who had HIAs don't start. There's three gone already. Your front row, Rory Best doesn't start. There's four. Maybe
one of the props comes out.
Yeah, I think Kilcoyne starts.
Yeah.
Five. So maybe more than five.
Maybe one in the second row, one in the back. Well, you mentioned O'Mahony in the back row. Then you're looking at Keith Earls has probably come in.
Yeah, I mean,
look at Keith Earls.
There's no weakening of the team. You're sticking Keith Earls in.
Yeah, and then does he put Rob Kearney in?
Rory O'Connor was saying Kearney didn't do the warm-up the other day, so he's probably a bit behind, and maybe you keep him in reserve and he can play the Russia game and take the small game off and play the South Africa game.
Yeah, it's...
It's all easy now.
It is. Like, it's kind of...
Like, it's still rugby where the opposition are allowed to try and beat the hell out of you.
And injuries.
And that's the injuries, yeah.
The thing, because it's so attritional now that, you know, you can pick up an injury in any game.
And Japan have got the nerves out of the way that first game, you know.
I kind of feel like Japan will be looking at Scotland, though. That's the target they have now, where they think Scotland are the game, because they lose to us and then it comes down to a shootout between them and Scotland.
They don't want to be underestimated, though. they've had some big results, especially the last World Cup, you know.
So no easy games, Andy.
No easy games.
Well, there's some easy games. There's some fairly easy games. It's still a Rugby World Cup. It hasn't quite reached the... there's still some pretty easy games in the Soccer World Cup. Feel good stuff. Thanks very much for that. Andy, thanks for being with us today.
Thanks, yeah.
That's all we've got for you on OTB AM this morning. Stay tuned to OTB Sports Radio across the day. You can listen in on offtheball.com/radio, or you can get us on the Go Loud app. Off the Ball is back on the radio tonight from 7 o'clock. Vinnie Perth will be on Dundalk's league win. And we'll be back tomorrow morning here from 7:30 a.m. Good luck.
That was an Off the Ball Podcast Network presentation.